Hello and welcome to Essential Dissent, coming to you from the last days of the U.S. Empire. I'm Wilton Vaught, producer of the series. In this episode, peace activist Jack Gilroy interviews fellow activist Ruth Benn on the subject of war tax resistance. Co-author of the book War Tax Resistance, A Guide to Withholding Your Support from the Military, Ruth Benn was on the staff of the War Resisters League from 1987 to 2000 and was the coordinator of the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee from 2003 to 2018. She has been refusing to pay federal income taxes for war since 1979. According to Ruth Benn, tax refusal can be summed up in the phrase, don't pay, and the actual steps to get there can be simple or a bit more complicated, depending on one's life situation, sources of income, motivations, and willingness to take risks. In the interview, she outlines how to get started, methods, potential consequences, resources, etc. Jack Gilroy is an activist with Veterans for Peace and has served multiple prison terms for various acts of nonviolent civil resistance. The interview took place on May 4, 2025 at the Upstate Anarchist Book Fair in Binghamton, New York, which was sponsored and hosted by PM Press. Please note that the views expressed on Essential Dissent are those of the individual speakers and do not necessarily represent my own views or those of this radio station.
So, Ruth, so good to know you. I'll introduce myself as Jack Gilroy, a longtime activist in the southern tier of New York, and just heard about you recently through Wilton Vaught, who, of course, has the program Essential Dissent. So, Wilton asked that I sit and have a chat with you about you and about what you've been doing. And I just picked something up on the internet, Ruth. It's so easy to find out about you.
Yes, I'm afraid so.
And you pronounce your last name?
Just Benn.
Benn.
Ruth Benn.
Ruth Benn, then, it says here, is a key figure with the War Resisters League, co-edited two books, War Tax Resistance, A Guide to Withholding Your Support from the Military, with Ed Hederman. Additionally, she co-authored and edited War Resisters League, 100 Years of Resistance to War, in the Causes of War, with Ed Hederman. Now, we need to discuss both books, but, you know, I would really like first, Ruth, to try to get to the root and roots of Ruth. What was it that led you to have this long, distinguished career as a war resister? Give us a little bit of your background, your youth.
Background? Well, I grew up in Indiana, but came of age during the Vietnam War, so that is the deciding factor, really. And it did happen that my family, even though we lived in Indiana, they were fairly liberal. And I had an older sister and brother who were both in college and involved in Vietnam-era protests. So yeah, it kind of filtered down to me. It took me a while to really get active in the movement. I suppose I eventually made my way east and ended up in Northampton, Massachusetts for a few years. And I met Francis Crowe, who was a longtime activist with the American Friends Service Committee. And she wrangled me into the anti-war, anti-nuke movement at the end of the 70s, early 80s. So that kind of did it for me. Frances was quite the activist and well-known in Northampton. She turned 100 and unfortunately is not with us anymore, but had a long anti-war career. So she's my mentor. And I eventually looked for a movement job and ended up in New York City. I worked for Middle East Report briefly and took me a little while to find War Resisters League, but I joined the staff in 1987. And I was on the staff pretty much about 13 years. My main work was editing the magazine, which at the time was called The Nonviolent Activist, and also War Tax Resistance. And, you know, on a small staff, you do many, multiple tasks. But so on from there, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah. I'd just like to go back just for a minute or two to Indiana. Now, I don't know a lot about Indiana, but I think of Indiana, I think of an awful lot of conservatism in Indiana. Your parents, you said, were considered at the time liberal. You must have seen some resistance to even their objection to what was going on.
Yeah, you know, well, I was In high school, I don't know how much attention you pay to your parents, actually, what's really going on in their lives. But my father worked at the newspaper. He was the managing editor of the local paper. And so, yeah, his liberal take did come into conflict many times with his bosses and with the publisher of the paper. But we lived in northern Indiana, which is a little different than the southern part of the state, and had a lot of Chicago influence on our activism. So, yeah, I do remember, you know, certainly in high school, we did have active anti-war work there during the moratoriums. I know we wore black armbands and had some big rallies. But, yes, there were also opposition people. Honestly, I'm trying to remember the name of the sort of very opposition group of older men in particular, probably and
John
veterans.
Birchers. Or...
Yes, the John Birchers. Yeah, exactly. You know, they would turn out at any of these events to give the other side, so to speak. So, yeah, there certainly was active opposition, but I was pretty naive and kind of just not totally aware of everything around me at the time, I guess.
Well, you were quite young during the civil rights, the early civil rights movement, but are there memories there that you might have?
You know, mostly being aware of it. I mean, my parents were certainly sympathetic. And I know my mother eventually joined, was part of a group in our town. Indiana was quite the Klan state, of course. But, you know, I guess where we lived, I just wasn't in my consciousness. And I kind of look back and think, wow, I really like missed something at the time. I feel like I hear of some other activists who were so aware in high school, and I feel like I maybe wasn't, maybe because I was kind of shy and, you know, just was very quiet about what I was doing or something.
Well, that was great background, though. They have your father as an editor, and there must have been discussions at the dinner table, et cetera, that were picking up on, for sure.
Yes, he was no fan of Lyndon Johnson, so there was a lot of pounding on the table, lecturing.
So the Vietnam movement, you were... Were you in high school around that time?
I graduated in 1970, so I did go to Indiana University. And, you know, I was a little bit more probably in Democrat, kind of the liberal Democrat politics at the time, and, you know, working for the peace candidate a little bit and that sort of thing. And the women's movement was very active there, and I was pretty shy, so I wasn't terribly involved but kind of aware of these things around me.
Including Kent State.
Yeah, sure.
You were around at that time. I just wanted to see, before we move into some deeper issues here, what about the nuclear abolition movement? Did that eventually touch you over the years?
Oh, definitely. By the time I got to Northampton and started working with Francis Crowe, that was one of the major issues we worked on in the early 80s. When I started out, we were really working on Carter, the saintly President Carter, who had raised the military budget significantly, also instituted draft registration. And that was like late 70s, 79. So we were very involved in the draft registration issue. And honestly, that is what got me into Wartax resistance, because I was out tabling and handing out literature to young men saying, you know, think about this before you register for the draft. And I was not going to be drafted myself. But I did learn about Wartax resistance and realized this was something that I could do that was somehow a little bit equivalent to the kind of resistance we were suggesting to these young men who were heading to the post office to register. And then, yes, into the anti-nuclear movement and,
I'm sure there's a major story you could tell there. The thing that I think a lot of listeners would be interested in is something that you've focused on very much so over the years, and that is resistance to war taxes. In other words, tax resistance. Could you tell us a bit about how you got involved in that, and what were some of the things that you did?
Yeah, well, I was working at the American Friends Service Committee, and this the book that we just published is the sixth edition, actually, of the Guide to War Tax Resistance. And the first one was 1981, and Ed Hedeman, who was on the staff of the War Resisters League, was the original author of the book. We've worked on it together the last three editions. But I ran into the book and just thought, here I am at the American Friends Service Committee, peace, Quaker organization, working for peace. Why would I want any money to go to war? It just didn't make sense to me. So I started investigating it, and it also happens that in the Pioneer Valley in western Massachusetts, there was a very active group of war tax resistors around Wally and Juanita Nelson up in Deerfield, Massachusetts, who were low-income, simple-living resistors, but also many other resistors in that area, the Pioneer Valley war tax resistance. So it was pretty easy to learn about war tax resistance in that area. They were always out on tax day. And I wasn't super involved in the organizing and that sort of, and that end of it at the time, but I was certainly became aware of war tax resistance and the network that existed, at least in that area. So,
a lot of people that I know respect those individuals who are resistors, war tax resistors, but say, I could never do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what do you say to people who say, this is a bridge too far for me?
Yeah, well, one thing about war tax resistance, it is always a little hard to explain because it depends on how, you know, people's finances, how they're living, what kind of job they have and all, you know, lots of different things, what kind of economic risk they're willing to take, because it really is more of an economic risk. You know, you see so many people who are willing to do a civil disobedience action, get arrested. Of course, now some of the charges are getting much more substantial for a lot of the actions we're seeing around Palestine and certainly even climate issues. But the people who, you know, will go out and cross the line and be willing to get arrested. But somehow, you know, when it comes to money, it is a more difficult step. And I think people have this illusion that it has to be all or nothing. I have to, like, completely drop out and never pay the IRS and never file. Or if I'm filing, I have to refuse everything that I owe. And I think a lot of us feel like it really isn't the amount of money. It's the act of resistance. And it is one that the government has paid attention to over the years. They don't want people to think about not paying. So, I think people can start out small. A lot of us did, started at, you know, very low levels of resistance and kind of felt empowered over the years and felt stronger and, up the ante as time went on. So for myself, I do resist 100% of the federal income tax that's owed, but I do pay state and local taxes. And I have paid into Social Security over the years. So, you know, there are various choices that you can make that lessen the risk. But also, I just think any level of resistance is worth it.
A couple of questions on that point. Number one, suppose a person did want to not pay 54%, which is very often the figure between 50 and 54% of the amount of money that the federal government uses for militarism, past wars, present wars, preparing for more war. How would an individual go about doing that?
Yeah. Well, it depends on how you're making your money, of course. For those of us who are self-employed, it's much easier because you are sort of semi-voluntarily told to pay estimated taxes, which, you know, quarterly during the year if you're self-employed, so that you've kind of paid some money in before having to file at the end of the year. So you have power over those estimated payments. And sometimes it takes a while to figure out, like, if your salary is pretty stable, if what you're paid over the year is pretty stable, then you can kind of see, all right, if I pay this much less than estimated, I'll owe about that 50% at the end of the year, and then I can refuse that amount. But if you're salaried, it's a little more complicated because you have to change the W-4 form, which is the form you get when you take a job, or I think people might get it online these days, and I've never done it that way, but I think employers might have a automated system for it. And you have to now, on that W-4, take more deductions in order to reduce the withholding from your paycheck. And it might be something you have to play with over the course of a year to look at your pay stub and see what's being taken out and kind of figure out, you know, am I going to owe at the end of the year? And whatever amount you might owe at the end of the year, you can decide if you're going to pay some or all of that.
In other words, if I only have, let's say, one or two deductions, but I say, well, I'm going to claim eight deductions. And this would mean that there will be a big chunk of that money that would come back to me at the end of the year, which would be federal, reducing the amount that you put in the federal military budget.
Right. I mean, actually, it's a way to reduce the amount you've lent them during the year also. Right. You've given them a no-interest loan with your withholding. So even if you're able, you know, a lot of people get a refund and they think, yay, I got my money back. But actually, you probably didn't, you know, unless you really didn't owe anything.
Yeah.
You paid something and they gave you back what you overpaid as a loan. So that money you loaned was doing whatever they do with it, which much of which we don't like. So at least getting your withholding into balance so that you don't have this refund and lend the money is one way. I think the way the form is now, they changed it a few years ago, and you have to do it by deductions, and it has to do with the personal, the standard deduction, which a single person is, I don't know, 18,000 or something now. And, you know, take the standard deduction, and then if you don't have any other credits and own a house that might have some ways to reduce it, you have to up the amount on the line 4B on the W-4 form, which is adding to your deductions. If it's your standard is 18 or whatever it is, then you might need to take 25,000 on that deduction line to bring down the withholding. So yeah, it's a little complicated. And their National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee has, which a War Resisters League is a founding member of National War Tax Resistance. They have a ton of resources on their website, but they do have a little video of how to fill out the W-4. And also there's a very simple leaflet online too, that there's a lot of resources online, but a leaflet about W-4 resistance and another booklet, and you can read about it. And there are some potential consequences down the line. It usually takes a couple years for the IRS to decide, this person's withholding must be off, and then they tell the employer to change it. Usually there could be a fine, there could be penalties, but they haven't been applying those. They've mostly just been automatically changing the form. So
if a person was to do, say, a simple Google search of war resisters information, they would come across the
War Tax Resistance.
War Tax Resistance.
If you search on War Tax Resistance, our organizations will come up. And National War Tax Resistance has really a pretty, sometimes overwhelming website, but a good section of resources that people can read online.
So probably the fear factor is one reason why people do not resist tax, and in other words, do not fight the system by reducing their federal income tax. Now, there are ways, though, that you can get around that. Is it common for people, for example, to be charged by the federal government or to go to jail or prison or lose their homes? How often does something like that occur?
Yeah, that's quite rare, actually. I mean, we talk about the modern war tax resistance movement as starting in World War II. So these people like Wally and Juanita Nelson up in, who lived in Western Massachusetts, were World War II resistors and began war tax resistance right after the war. And it's their pattern of resistance that, you know, we've learned from and followed and built on over these decades. And in all those years, there have been maybe around 30, 32 people who've been jailed related to war tax resistance. Usually it's not because you didn't pay, it's because you wouldn't give them information when you go to the office if they call you in or whatever. So there are often other charges. There have been a few people since then who had pretty conscientious reasons for not wanting to pay, but did a few things that led more to fraud charges. And that's what people have to watch out for, is not underestimating your income. And some of these few people, there were three or four of them, found us after they kind of got in trouble with the IRS, and they did spend some time in jail. I think most of them a little less than a year, in a few different places in the country. So those were the most recent ones, and that was a decade ago or so, of anybody in our network who's been to jail. Otherwise, the penalties, tend to be economic, that the IRS, it's fairly easy for them to take bank accounts if they know about them, or to freeze whatever you owe that's in the bank account. They don't take the whole account. If you have $2,000 in and you owe $1,000, they'll freeze $1,000 and eventually take it out unless you pay or do some settlement with them, or to levy a salary. Those are the most common things that happen. And yeah, it is, you know, I'd say it is scary. I think, you know, people are very intimidated when you get your first collection letter from the IRS. And I, you know, I still get letters. I get letters regularly. And yeah, every time one comes, I do get a little like stab in my heart, like, oh dear, what is it this time? But I only in my decades of resisting now have had a couple meetings with the IRS. And yeah, it was kind of scary at the time. They did not follow through in the way they could have and just went back to collection letters after, you know, threatening me. So in that way, it's very empowering. You usually find that they don't really do the worst things that you think they can do. And sometimes if they do the worst thing, like take a house, which also hasn't happened since the 1990s, people find that there's a surge of support around them and somehow they come through it and feel even stronger, you know, in their conviction. That has happened with a lot of longtime resistors. So
financial assistance that people do as outreach to those who may have been penalized by?
Yeah, or just protests even. And, you know, if the times when these houses were seized in the late 80s and early 90s, a couple houses, there were a lot of protests and a lot of forcing a lot of delays by the IRS trying to figure out what to do with all these protests, or they, you know, they auctioned the house. So there were lots of bids for community service and food for the hungry and all kinds of things as opposed to bids for the house. So there have been some wonderful actions around some of these things. Honestly, it's harder to have a protest around a salary levy. That's a difficult thing these days. You know, if somebody has a bank account taken, some people have had protests at their banks, but it's a little harder to get excitement around some of those just more computer things that they can do.
Well, the IRS, of course, has been reduced in numbers and importance by the Trump administration. It's going to be even more difficult than for them to, it would seem to me, to be tracking down war resistors.
Yeah.
Tax resistors.
I mean, actually, it's happened over the last probably 15 years of after the tax protests by more conservative people, let's say, some years ago, the Republicans who got into Congress were very much part of that and don't like the IRS. So they've been cutting the IRS for years. And that has slowed down collection tremendously. And certainly anything like an audit, those are mostly automated now. They're not much hitting our network, although they do go after people with the earned income credit. And that's something the IRS has needed to change. But yeah, so the IRS has lost a lot of staff over the years, and it has, you know, I don't do it to get away from it. I file. I'm very open. As you found, you can find me on the internet pretty easily about what I'm doing. And I have some debt with the IRS. So I never got into it expecting that I wouldn't have severe consequences, but I guess I've also learned to kind of shape my life around the resistance that's made it harder for them maybe to collect. But so it is true that the IRS does have a harder time with collection these days. And so Trump is cutting more. Biden had added some money and was particularly, supposedly, all these new collection agents were going to go more after high-income people who weren't filing. But now all that money is being taken away again, and they fired some 6,000 people so far, maybe more, from the IRS. So, yeah, we'll see what happens. I mean, Trump actually does have a desire to get rid of the IRS. He has this idea that tariffs and other fees are going to make up for taxes that aren't paid, and we'll see what happens. So, yeah, we're kind of in a new era here of what it might look like.
And he's calling for not just a reduction in education, health, welfare, et cetera, but an increase, 13%, I believe, in military spending.
Yes, absolutely. So all the more reason to keep up with all our levels of resistance to this budget and all the things, all the people that it's going to hurt. It gives us a moment to talk about redirection, because for those of us who actually file and have some taxes that we refuse, a lot of us also give it away. You know, we call it redirection. And we take whatever the IRS and the federal government want and give it to the groups in our community or to victims of war, to the other things that are being cut. And especially now, I think, you know, people's salaries are probably not going to increase either. It's going to be much more difficult for so many nonprofit organizations in the coming years. So anything that we can do with our redirection and other efforts to transfer money from the federal government to the places where it's being cut is important. And yeah, I've heard, you know, when Trump first got elected, quite a few people talked about, well, he says he's going to end these wars and make peace. But yeah, now we see the military, this is the truth, the military budget is going up. So we do a pie chart every year that analyzes the federal budget. But because they were so late this year, we put it out before tax day. So we were only making a guess on our latest War Resisters League flyer, where your income tax money goes, about what the coming year might look like. And clearly, I will see a higher percentage to military and less to other parts. Yes, social services and everything else.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. In this episode, peace activist Jack Gilroy interviews fellow activist Ruth Benn on the subject of war tax resistance. Co-author of the book War Tax Resistance, A Guide to Withholding Your Support from the Military, Ruth Benn was on the staff of the War Resisters League from 1987 to 2000 and was the coordinator of the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee from 2003 to 2018. She has been refusing to pay federal income taxes for war since 1979.
I noticed that there have been some bit of a revision to the annual pie chart of the War Resisters League. Could you explain for us the chart, the pie chart, and how long you've been doing it, and how people can get this and perhaps use it?
It's on the War Resisters League website, so it's warresisters.org. I think also if you search on pie chart War Resisters, it will come up in a simple search. But we do take the budget that's published by the federal government, and it's supposed to come out in February. It's been coming out. And when there's a new administration, it usually is late, as it is this year. I expect the Trump administration would rather not do a budget. They would like to just do whatever they're doing without telling anybody about it. So I don't know if they've actually published the books yet. But we actually analyze the budget in the books by where your federal income taxes go. It's not Social Security, not Medicare. Those do get tracked into a trust fund and are held separately. If you have a salary job, you can't resist Social Security and Medicare. And self-employed people are asked to pay into that, of course. It's a large chunk of what you pay as a self-employed person. So anyway, we're looking at where the income taxes go. It's both discretionary and some mandatory spending. You see other pie charts that do have a larger amount to the military, and they're just looking at the discretionary portion of the budget, which is what Congress can change every year. But there are some other parts of the budget that are mandatory that they have to go through more stages, like Medicaid, to change. Over the years, in the beginning, the chart was first done in 1985, and the way that the federal budget is presented, they have codes for different functions of the budget. And military has its own codes, you know, 051 or 52, various numbers like that. So we go through the budget looking for the military items, and then that's mostly the Pentagon, and also the Energy Department, and that's where nuclear weapons are budgeted. All of that spending, except for the delivery systems, is in is in the Energy Department. So for years, those were kind of the two big areas. War Resisters League also added in the Coast Guard, seeing that as an armed kind of military unit. A lot of people didn't agree with that. And we looked at the debt, the interest on the debt, because the debt for decades was really mostly military. Going back even to the Civil War in the 1980s, the last pension or a granddaughter from some Civil War veteran was paid in, I don't know, maybe about 8 years ago or something. I mean, really, it was in the budget for years. So, of course, for the early years of federal budgeting, the taxes in any country you look at this, they have to tax when they have a war. That's when they decide they must figure out taxation. So yeah, for years, those were the major categories were really past military. And that does include veterans. And some people take issue with that yes, we should pay for our veterans. And we're not necessarily saying don't pay for veterans, but we're saying it is a cost of war. And it's a huge cost of war after Iraq and Afghanistan, also Vietnam. Just a huge cost has added up over the years, and the healthcare services that so many of these people need, and mental health issues and housing support, as so much that's needed for veterans. But of course, everyone should have healthcare. That's also how we feel about caring for people, that not just veterans, but everyone. So anyway, we're looking at the cost of war. But the main change in more recent years has been after 9/11, President Bush merged some departments into Homeland Security, and that's where the Border Patrol is, and the Coast Guard is there now, TSA, a lot of these armed parts of the government also are in Homeland Security. And so we started doing a kind of a percentage of Homeland Security. Now we put almost all of it in there because so much is border, so much is militarized. And, you know, you look at Homeland Security and you say, okay, if we have Homeland Security, then why is there a Department of so-called Defense? Go back to the original name. That's the Department of War. And that is what the Pentagon is doing these days. So, yeah, there's military money in the State Department. It's kind of seeping through a lot of other departments now. So we try to sort through the budget pretty carefully to decide how we're doing our pie chart. So if Trump puts out printed budgets next year, then we'll be able to do more specifically a budget this time.
I think the national priorities has pretty much stayed to the 54% discretionary. And is there any, you know, collaboration with you and national priorities? Do you agree or disagree on issues?
Well, actually, they do two things. They put out the discretionary portion because they focus a lot more on lobbying than we do, you know, and telling people how much your state is losing, really, in because of the military budget. It's nationalpriorities.org. They do have an excellent website. I use it all the time. We often a reference on our pie chart. Yeah, so we're not much of a lobbying organization. We're really like direct action. You know, take this information, and the pie chart was originally created for war tax resistors to say you can decide, you know, do you want to pay this year we have 50% this year. It's usually around 50%. You know, do you want to resist the 50% or the current military 24% or the whole thing? Because anything you pay, you know, some of it's going to be used by the military. But National Priorities also analyzes income tax portion, and they have two different sections on their pie chart on their website, where they also show where your income taxes go. And they have a little income tax receipt that you can fill out and say how much you sent to the IRS, and they'll show you what percentage of that, what the breakdown of that is, how much went to the military and other places. So yeah, they have really good resources on their website. So yeah.
I think a key question for people would be, yes, I'm a school teacher, and I feel like I'm absolutely in need of making a statement about the waste of funds going to prepare to kill people around the world, basically. And so how do I go about reducing my taxes? How do you speak to someone who gives you a question like that?
A teacher is someone who's salaried. And so there is the issue of the W-4 and deciding, you know, if you're getting a refund or whatever, how you're going to adjust the W-4 so that you'd be able to owe at the end of the year. And of course, you know, when you go to do your 1040, you can still decide, oh, I just really am too scared. I'm going to pay it all anyway, you know. So you still have that moment at the end. You might have a little extra charge for under withholding, but there always is that other option right at the end of, you know, to file. Your first step might be just to send a letter with your form if you're filing, you know. People are filing online these days. The IRS, of course, wanted to push everybody online, and that means they can have fewer staff. If you're filing online, we encourage people to not pay directly from your bank account, but to get the receipt and then be able to mail that in with your payment. And then you can mail a letter too saying, you know, I'm really angry about where this money's going. I really want to see a change. We also encourage people to send those letters to their congresspeople. Even though we're not hugely interested in lobbying, still, you know, let people know how angry you are about where these taxes go. And a lot of resistors will send their congressperson the letter saying, I didn't pay, I'm not going to pay, I didn't pay this amount because I'm so angry. So, you know, or letters to the editor that also get the word out. So, you know, you could start with just the letter protest. National War Tax Resistance also has a peace tax return on their website, and people could look for that. It kind of gives you a little step-by-step way to choose how you're going to resist or not resist and just send in a little protest statement. So I like to file on paper because, it also continues to annoy them. It's like being a little cog in the system of, you know, just mucking it up a little bit, making them have to enter your information. Yeah. So, you know, there are things like that. But somebody could also just refuse $10, you know, just whatever feels safe in their economic situation. So, yeah.
Ruth, does the War Resisters League or any other tax resistance group have workshops where they could come to a community and teach people some of the specifics of how to go about resisting tax?
Yeah, there are some in the War Resisters League, and a lot of us are on the contacts and counselors list of National War Tax Resistance. So National War Tax Resistance is kind of the umbrella organization for this network of resistors. And so a lot of us make sure that we're listed on the counselors list, and it also is on their website. And you can find emails or phone numbers for people all around the country there. And there is actually an international network also. It's kind of weak these days, but there are some resistors in European countries and other places. So we've had people from Palestine participate over the years, and also Latin America, Colombia. So, yeah, it's a wide network. And National War Tax Resistance also keeps basically a basic workshop online. People can go to the website and just watch this maybe half hour. War Tax Resistance 101 is what it's called. So you can also search on that. It's on YouTube. And
War Tax Resistance 101, yeah, plus a search, just the general search. Yeah, that would be great you would think at a time now where corporations, many of them not paying any taxes, billionaires, and I like to remind people about their elementary school meaning of what $1 billion is. When I was young, we didn't even hear of $1 trillion. That was never spoken of. But to keep in mind that it takes 1,000 million to make 1 billion, I think begins to, people very often confuse millions with billions, but there's quite a difference there. And if people could begin to think the amount of multi-billions that corporations and that individual billionaires, I would think that a lot of them would be rushing to the War Resisters League and the National Tax Resistance for workshops or to learn on their own. So thanks for giving us that information.
Yeah, well, I would say particularly with Gaza over the last couple of years, you know, war tax resistance kind of rises and falls with the wars that are going on or the peace movement in general. But in the last couple of years, the horrifying U.S. support and Israeli bombing in Gaza and the genocide in Gaza has really drawn a lot of people to war tax resistance. And so, yes, we've all been doing a lot of workshops and getting a lot more phone calls than we had for years. And yes, now with Trump, there's also that surge, as there was in 2016 when he was elected, of people really being upset about where their money's going. So.
Yeah. One or two other things that I would really like to have you look at. You know, there's been talk recently of a general strike occurring in this country, and an assistance in sort of a similar situation. What you're calling for is sort of a general strike in terms of tax resistance. What comes first, influencing people to refuse to pay their taxes? Or do you foresee, for someone who has been very close to what is happening, that a general strike is possible in this country in coming months or years?
Yeah. Honestly, I don't know. I don't know. You know, yes, I you know, you see the calls and some of the actions that have gone on lately. I mean, certainly those hands-off actions drew thousands of people to the streets. So, yeah, I think it's been very hard to get that kind of action developed in the U.S., but maybe we're getting closer to that moment. Yeah, we'll see. And there also, at the same time, are some new calls for tax strike. I know there's a website, and I don't totally know who's behind it, but people could look at it. It's taxstrike.info. And people could check that out, because they actually, on that website, also have the National War Tax Resistance WTR 101. And they have a new version of a nice little Getting Started in War Tax Resistance. They have a link to it. I think it's also on the National War Tax Resistance website, which is kind of maybe five steps that help you get through it. So we'll see how that develops. These are, you know, very new things. And somebody sent me a link for another one the other day that I think it's like Resistance 2025 that had some tax resistance info on it. So, yeah, I'm hopeful that we'll see some real development in this area and the general strike area, but I'm no better at predicting than anyone else, I guess.
Right. Well, Lech Walesa, remember Lech way back in the years in Poland, when he was attempting, when the Poles were attempting to move the oppressors out of their economy and country, they succeeded. And he said afterwards that the oppression came down without breaking a pane of glass. It seems like what you are talking about is not any sort of militant revolutionary act, but an act of nonviolence where you're refusing to give taxes that are actually promoting violence. And so do you think that this might be a pitch that that will really begin to develop as the United States, with 800 bases around the world, and with the Trump administration saying more and more money devoted to killing and violence, do you think that your time has come, in a sense, to really get the people moving to just simply stop paying taxes?
Yeah, well, we'll keep trying. I am hopeful in all these ways, you know, that, you know, I see tax resistance as a, you know, one element in this whole network of non-cooperation. I like that word in terms of this, you know, what's happening now is non-cooperate in all the ways that we can with what's coming down and support the communities and the people that need it. Yeah, you don't know what that moment is that really does push it over the edge, you know, and bring it. But certainly War Resisters League is a pacifist, nonviolent, an organization promoting nonviolent action. That's what we keep working for sure. I mean, I think it is dangerous with Gaza. You feel the anger when you're out there, and how can we not be angry? Mm-hmm. And how to channel that anger into this non-cooperation and non-violent protest. It's tough. Yeah. It's tough.
Like the East Germans, eventually they just couldn't take it any longer, and they began tearing down the wall. It was almost instantaneous,
right.
You know, building up over the years, but the action itself,
right.
That's where it would seem that the tax resistance would be a good part of a general strike.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Ruth. Is there anything else that you might want to say to listeners?
You know, if you have a little fear about it, just start looking into it. Dip your toe in, you know, start there. And speaking of Veterans for Peace nationally, I think they have also been querying, and I think they might even have a task force on or some small committee on war tax resistance
they
now.
Do.
So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, another group that we intersect with often and also Peace Action. So, yeah.
Veterans for Peace philosophy and the tone and the policy is not to engage in war, to use diplomacy.
Right.
And that is how we separate ourselves from almost all veterans groups. We feel that there's a greater need to go back to the true armistice of 1918, which is not to praise warriors, but to thank that peace has finally come and to prevent future wars through negotiations, diplomacy. Thank you very much, Ruth.
Thank you, Jack.
Yeah, it was very nice speaking with you.
You're listening to Essential Dissent. That was peace activist Jack Gilroy interviewing fellow activist Ruth Benn on the subject of war tax resistance. Co-author of the book War Tax Resistance, A Guide to Withholding Your Support from the Military, Ruth Benn was on the staff of the War Resisters League from 1987 to 2000, and was the coordinator of the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee from 2003 to 2018. She has been refusing to pay federal income taxes for war since 1979. We'll end with excerpts from the Q&A from her presentation at the book fair.
If you are opting to not file, is it just kind of a waiting game to see if they notice? Like, how does it work if you do state taxes but not federal? What does that look like after that?
It probably depends to some extent on what your income is. I mean, supposedly during Biden's term, when he gave the IRS a bunch more money, that money was supposed to be for high-income non-filers, that they were going to start tracking down high-income non-filers. I would expect that's like, you know, possibly in the hundreds of thousands because they saw that there were a bunch of people not filing. If they get, you know, if they're getting W-2s or a 1099 that shows substantial income, you know, this could be like $10,000, you know, if one job is sending a pretty sizable chunk, they might eventually match that. And it could take a year or two, you know, could take longer, that they might eventually match that back to somebody who hasn't been filing. But, you know, I don't know absolutely for sure, like, what the level would be. And we are in this new era of most of that Biden money that he put in has been pulled back. And now they've fired 6,000 IRS employees, something like that. A lot of the new people who were added under Biden. Really in the long term, Trump hates the IRS, and a lot of the Republicans in Congress who came out of the Tea Party movement and got elected after that Tea Party movement about a dozen years ago, whatever that was, most of them, you know, they've been the ones who've been cutting the IRS for years. So, and they got way behind during the pandemic. We'll see now how much collection they're going to be doing and how much they're going to notice. I think it's a good time to start resistance because it might take them longer to get around to finding people. It's kind of a gray area at this point. And, you know, I don't know what they're, I haven't seen their budget stuff, but so far, everything they're talking about with they want to cut taxes at the same time they're raising military, you know, their revenue stream doesn't match their expense stream. And, they're trying to cut all these programs, but they're still not getting close to not racking up more debt and having a so-called balanced budget.
So, you know, whether the Congress will say, hey, you know, we need to ramp up the IRS. I mean, even after the pandemic, when, you know, they all were working outside, they, you know, people didn't work for a while, and then they, the IRS employees, and then were working from home or whatever they were doing, they got way behind. They got about 2 years behind. So it was only last summer that they started sending letters again to those of us who were resisting. So it took them a long time just to even get back to the letter stage. The question is about the letter sequence. So when you file and you don't pay, basically, unless there's something that they're really suspicious about in your form and your filing, you basically go straight to collection. So your form just is sent over to the collection division, and that's pretty much my whole history of resistance is straight to collection, you know. So yes, there's a series of letters they send, usually three. The first one is kind of a, oops, did you forget something sort of letter from the IRS. Yeah, pay, I think you have 30 days or something. We want to hear from you in 30 days. And the second letter is more demanding. You must pay within this amount of time or worse things will happen. And it's the third letter that you really have to watch out for. It could come as a second letter, but it's called, it has a message on it, a title on it that's intent to levy. And so the intent to levy letter is the one that I think they give you 10 days to pay. And if you haven't paid in 10 days, then the IRS has the power to levy a salary, take from Social Security for people on Social Security, or take from a bank account. So they have the power to do it. But the thing about the IRS is you never know when they're going to do it. And this is, I think, what also makes war tax resistance really hard, is this mystery of, are they going to get me or aren't they going to get me? As opposed to, like, doing a direct action, crossing the line, getting arrested, getting some charges, you know, going to court. War tax resistance is, yeah, it has this this mystery level about it. So it usually is not the next day. I mean, it might be a year before you have a salary levy. Yeah, it really varies. And it might be never. You know, if people are in a career job, the IRS is more likely to come around. If people feel flexible about their employment, the way to avoid a salary levy or to end it is to quit the job. That's pretty much the only way. There are very few employers who won't honor a salary levy. Just a couple, like War Resistance League and National War Tax Resistance, and maybe one or two others somewhere. You know, there's been a lot of pressure on churches like the Quakers not to honor salary levies. But so, yeah, and that's kind of the letter series. And you know, and then they'll, like, start again. Sometimes they will start again, you know, or each year you at least get that series of letters. On occasion, they used to send a letter at the, like, with 10 years, showing your whole 10 years of how much you owed, adding up the whole debt. And I haven't seen one of those in quite a while. So, yeah, I think those are the main ones that come. And no one in our network has been summoned to the IRS, which is a, you know, legal demand for you to go visit them in, I don't know, I got a summons in 2009. That might have been about the last time that I was called into the IRS. And I don't know what my debt might, I don't, never made that much money, so my debt might be 20,000 now. At that time, it was 40. It was about 40,000. And they didn't follow up. They have this long form where they want you to tell, like, it was about four pages, answer these questions about every possible place you might have your money invested in this, that, and the other thing, what your assets are. And for a lot of us over the years, we learned that if you take the Fifth Amendment on this form, and every question, the Fifth Amendment, that pretty much ended it. And they could go higher, but they didn't for me. So, and yeah, I mean, there is a certain level of fear in having to go talk to the IRS or getting a letter from them. I mean, I still always am a little like, oh, what is it now? You know, what's going to happen now? But for whatever reason, it hasn't, you know, it's been important to me to keep resisting. And whatever happens, judging from other people in our network who've had worse, who've had houses taken in the way past or whatever, people get through it and figure out the next thing. And, you know, I might talk about it a little casually, which is because I've been doing it so long, of course, and over the years have been able to adjust how I live my life. You know, I was salaried and I became an independent contractor. And I knew that I would never own a house, you know, that I would never own much. I do own a car, but they've never come for that. And I've worked, you know, as self-employed, quite a few different jobs, and always known that I would quit if a levy came. So, you know, you kind of figure out what your life is going to look like and how much, you know, you can adjust to what comes along. Yeah, I mean, you know, certainly in my family and friends, most of them are not resistors. Most of them say, I admire what you do. I wish I could do it, but I just can't. And yeah, I don't know. I guess I don't really try to talk them into it. They know what I do. I try to, you know, I do try to explain it, I guess. You know, I think in war tax resistance, in the end, I know it comes down to the individual and their tax form. And even people who think they're the most willing when it comes to tax day and they're like dealing with all that craziness on the form, you know, they might just go, oh no, I can't do it at this time, you know. So it definitely, you know, I think I was in the movement long enough, in the peace movement long enough before what hit me was like, I'm working for peace and I'm paying for war. So yeah, it isn't going to be the first thing anybody does, that's for sure. But mostly I think we try by example to encourage people to give it a try. Yeah, I don't know if that helps, but I mean, we've done a lot of public speaking, just, you know, our radio shows, and gotten a lot of more nasty feedback than you know, I'm afraid to do it. But yeah, I try mostly to tell people it really actually does feel good. It's very empowering. I don't think in my anti-war work that anything made me feel as empowered as standing up to the IRS.
You've been listening to Essential Dissent. In this episode, peace activist Jack Gilroy interviewed Ruth Benn on the subject of war tax resistance. The interview took place on May 4, 2025 at the Upstate Anarchist Book Fair in Binghamton, New York, which was sponsored and hosted by PM Press. We then heard excerpts from the Q&A from Ruth Benn's presentation at the book fair. Co-author of the book War Tax Resistance, A Guide to Withholding Your Support from the Military, Ruth Benn was on the staff of the War Resisters League from 1987 to 2000 and was the coordinator of the National War Tax Resistance Coordinating Committee from 2003 to 2018. She has been refusing to pay federal income taxes for war since 1979. Jack Gilroy is an activist with Veterans for Peace and has served multiple prison terms for various acts of nonviolent civil resistance. Please note that the views expressed on Essential Dissent are those of the individual speakers and do not necessarily represent my own views or those of this radio station. I'm Wilton Vaught, saying thanks for listening, and remember, never believe anything until you hear the official denial.